Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Yes, good morning. Welcome to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Grateful to be broadcasting from the unceded and ancestral territory of the Pulkamilam and Squamish speaking peoples. I'm Jesse, and welcome to the show. We have a very, very jam-packed show today. Four recorded pieces, and we'll have a live call-in. So, unlike the usual pace of this show, which starts with some music and then builds up, we're just going to jump right into it. The first couple of pieces we're going to hear, or that you'll hear over the first half hour of the show, are with artists who are participating in IndieFest, which is happening, well, starting this Friday, November 15th to 23rd, over the next week or so, presented by Renaissance Opera. We're going to hear from Taya Kashihara, who is the star and co-creator of Eurydice Fragments, which kicks off the festival. But first, we will be hearing from Alexandra Caprara, who is the director and creator of Ultraviolets. And we talk all about it in this interview, so I will not waste any more time, and we will just get right into it.
My name is Alexandra Caprara. Most people call me Alex, and I am a former MFA of Simon Fraser's School of Contemporary Arts. I graduated last year, actually, and I am an interdisciplinary artist. I work primarily as a director, deviser, and also as a lighting designer. I'm originally from Toronto, Ontario, and I moved to Vancouver 3 years ago to pursue my MFA, and I've been lucky enough to work all around the world as an artist. And I primarily make work that is design-led and that focuses on interactivity between movement and and design in particular. And yeah, my philosophy around what I do, I'm a queer artist and I believe in making work about queer joy, and that tells these stories and that uplifts our community. And what else can I tell you? I'm a Capricorn. What else do you want to know?
Well, that's a good start. There's lots to pull from right there immediately. The thing that just stuck in my mind immediately is when you say design-led. What does that mean for me and our listeners?
So a design-led creation process basically thinks of design as a holistic part of a process. And it's often a starting point when we're creating new work. So as a deviser, when I'm making work that is design-led, often the choreography or the story actually comes from that relationship that we're building to how we interact with design on stage. In particular, that often for me means working with lighting as a dance partner on stage and using that as a vehicle to reveal new ways of looking at movement. This is also something I do a lot with video as well in design-led processes, where there's a sense of interactivity between the design that's happening on stage that makes it not less of an aesthetic thing, but more of a participant in the work itself and sort of an extension of whatever ensemble or performance that you have on stages.
Right. So instead of the lighting or other parts of the design being supplements to whatever the work is, they actually become part of it, is the idea?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. You also mentioned a focus on queer joy in your works. Why is it important to focus and highlight queer joy?
I think that queer joy is the greatest form of resistance, I think, especially after the past 2 days when things are incredibly dire. It is, in my opinion, as an artist, more important than ever to make space for queer joy to happen and for queer spaces to take place in the theater and dance world. And so often the work that I write about is reflective of this idea of eliciting queer joy or just imbuing my processes with queer joy for my collaborators and myself. It's a simple answer, but I think that it's the most true to my work, and it's remained true for the past few years of my practice.
It's a big question. How do you come to art? I was going to ask, how do you come to dance and theater? But it seems bigger and more wide ranging than that. How does making art become part of your life?
Oh my God. I think that it is a part of your life. I think, and I hope I'm answering your question in the right way, but I think that to be an artist, everything you do is kind of like filtered through like your lens of like your work and the kind of ideas that you're percolating on. And I think it's impossible as artists to not move through life and respond with our work, like whether you're a writer or a dancer or a theater maker. And I think that's been true for myself in my own practice, that the art that I make and the art that, you know, I write about is so reflective of my own lived experiences and lived experiences of people close to me and responses to that. Is that kind of, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
No, totally.
Right. I hope I...
Yeah, if there's, okay. I don't think there's a wrong answer to that kind of question, right?
Yeah.
Because it is very personal.
Yeah.
That does segue into talking about the work that we're here to talk about, Ultraviolets. I was reading about it, and the piece I read about it is prefaced with a quote from Bell Hooks that says, queer not as being about who you're having sex with, that can be a dimension of it, but queer as being about the self that is at odds with everything around it and that has to invent and create and find a place to speak and thrive and to live. And to me, that sounds like another way of saying how you were just answering the question about where your work comes from. Do you find that in creating art or doing creative work that you are also sort of creating this space for yourself?
I think, yes, the space for myself, but I think with this work in particular, space for my community. I think that it's a non-singular process to make art, especially queer art, that like... You have to have this collective community mindset, especially in this work. We actually feature 10 members from the community that feature in the work as an added ensemble. And that quote in particular was so central to that, kind of encompassed how we thought about the work itself. But also, I think it's really reflective and personal to me. I love Bell Hooks's work. And for me, it's less about the idea necessarily of making art, but really like a way of being. And I guess by extension, a way of making art, but this idea that we can persist past any sort of adversity and find that place to live and to be abundant in our joy and to hold each other as a community. That's kind of where that piece resonates with me and kind of in the work Ultraviolets as well.
Great. Ultraviolets is playing Thursday, November 21st and Friday, November 22nd at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media. Can you give us a brief introduction or overview of what we might expect if we go to see Ultraviolets?
Yes, absolutely. Ultraviolets has been described as a big gay greenhouse disco. It's heavily inspired by disco and queer club aesthetics, but also really inspired by plant life and how that relates to queer history. And I don't want people to go in thinking they're going to see, you know, disco in the way that we think of it with like ABBA and like Studio 58. It is unrelated to that. We really sort of contemporized this idea of what it means to think about disco and a queer club as a space for queer becoming to take place. So this greenhouse idea and this club idea have sort of been combined to create this place that queer people can live and be authentic and, you know, step into themselves on an individual level and on a community level. You can expect lots of haze, lots of disco balls in very unlikely places, strobe lighting, loud music. It's kind of like being in a club, but you're also following this ensemble of 15 people as they sort of jump cut between these ideas of what it means to become oneself on an individual level and on a communal level. And it's really fun. It's sort of, I don't want to give it away, but it's very much kind of like being inside a club at times, and also at times quite like somber and intimate. And for me, it was about putting sapphic, in particular, sapphic intimacy on stage and queer joy on stage. And with that kind of also comes moments of queer, like, catharsis and community and anger and love. Yeah.
Great. And again, I don't want you to give it away, but on the surface, queer club culture and plant growth cycles don't live right beside each other necessarily, in my mind anyway. Mm-hmm. Can you elucidate that connection a little bit without giving the whole thing away?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a very rich history, and you look at the idea of plants that have been used as symbols for queer resistance and metaphors for queer love and queer experiencing. I think of lavender and lavender menace. I think of, you know, the green flower and also pansies. And so a lot of that relationship comes from that history and how it's married to queer history. But on a choreographic level and design level, this piece was actually devised studying both plant growth cycles and the ways that plants move, and also studying iconic disco and club dance styles. So the movement is actually reflective of these two very different things, and they're all really dramaturgically combined under this idea of queer becoming. And I think, to circle back to the Bell Hooks quote, plants throughout history have been acting as this sort of agent of persistence, regardless of what's happened in the world. There's always a way for plants to thrive and find new ways to live and to continue on despite what's happened. And that also feels true within queer history, and in particular in the persistence of queer people making spaces for this joy and this catharsis to take place. So that's kind of where those two levels intersect. So you can sort of see that visually in our movement, but also on a larger level in the way that these two ideas kind of are parallel and also sometimes intersecting. Yeah, that's what I would say. I did like, you know, a whole year's worth of like MFA research. So I'm trying to like par it down to like, I promise it connects, but yeah.
That's great. And I can see the parallels in terms of, you know, resilience and regrowth and rebuilding between queer culture and plant growth. You've mentioned a couple times queer becoming, and I think I can piece that together in my mind, but can you give us how you would define queer becoming?
I think queer becoming, and often people think it means like the becoming of a queer person or their journey of coming out. And that's actually, I'm glad you asked this, that's actually not how we define it, especially because though I really do think this audience, the audience that we're, you know, making the show for is for fellow queer audiences, but on a larger idea, to queer a sense of becoming is to abstract your own sense of becoming oneself. And anyone can relate to the idea of growing into yourself and stepping into what is true and authentic for yourself. And so queer becoming for me is like an intentional abstraction of what that heteronormative process looks like. And that's reflected in the work, both in the way that we actually see the body and how it interacts with light. We intentionally sort of skew people's perspectives and make things intentionally look strange. And a lot of that definition comes from Sarah Ahmed's work, Queer Phenomenology. It's just a simple idea of, again, an intentional abstraction of a thing that is considered one way. And then in doing that abstraction, you're revealing new ways to look at the thing. So for us, queer becoming is a new way of examining how people become oneself. And in this work, the answers to that are through a metaphoric exploration of germination, rot, and photosynthesis, which for us is sort of this idea of being able to step into yourself, being able to sort of speak to and honor all of the hard grief and the cathartic things that come with becoming, and also this idea of becoming through a sense of community and environment.
You mentioned, you know, doing a year of MFA research and doing your MFA at SFU, which is where I am currently. What is the process of taking something that is as academic as MFA research and turning it into a piece of art for public consumption?
For me, those processes felt, it's interesting because at times they felt very separate. You have the writing side of your MFA and then the art making side of your MFA. And I built this show with five undergraduate dancers that were also in the SFU program at the time, who knew a bit about my research because it was so hands-on. I gave them some of that reading and some of that insight into the academic side. And then we really just used it as a jumping off point to devise from. So the research has kind of always been there in the periphery of the work as inspiration for me and as sort of a guiding post of the things that I wanted to accomplish as an artist and as a designer. But really, in this remount, actually, it's been kind of nice to truly separate it from the requirements of an MFA. And also, to I think that my hope as an artist is that this work is accessible. And so it was important for me to create a work that, though inspired heavily by a bunch of this research, anybody could kind of come in and relate to it and access it. So yes, this version of the piece feels one step removed away from that research, but it, of course, is still so filled with all the many, many books I had to read and articles I had to read, which is great. But I think it's a thing that is maybe just for me to kind of have, and not something that I think an audience needs to come into the work and understand it, if that makes sense.
Totally. And just touching on, you know, your hope that the work is accessible to the audience that comes, what broadly, what are your hopes for this work? What do you hope to accomplish, or what do you hope people take away from it?
Oh, I have so many hopes about this work. I mean, on the base level of these collaborators have brought in this community of dancers is that it creates visibility of queerness on stage and the diversity of what that looks like. And, you know, at its base level, that it elicits queer joy and that it elicits conversation and discourse about the importance of queer spaces and the importance of community. And also, I think the importance of having these conversations in both academic and contemporary spaces. I hope that people come into it and are able to relate to this idea of becoming, regardless of their own perspectives and what queer becoming might be or what this process is. But yeah, I hope that it opens up people's perspectives on both that And on a larger note, I hope that it opens up dialogues about how we can connect with plant life and with nature. I think that so much of this work was built around like our relationship to these plants that we grew and that we studied for a year. And so the show kind of opens with this land acknowledgement that we had written about being able to listen deeply to the world around you. And that also means listening to each other, but also to our environment and our communities. So I hope that it helps people kind of lock into that idea of listening and caring deeply about each other and about this world that we're in and the plant life that's on it and the people that are on it. Yes, and I hope people come and have a great time on like a more simple level. I hope that they enjoy it. I think they will enjoy it. People have said good things. So
that's
hopefully they like it.
Always a primary consideration. The audience should have a good time, right? Or
I hope we'll have a good time. Yeah.
Okay, is there anything else you think myself or the audience should know about ultraviolets?
I think come see it is my final thing I will say. This piece was just, it's a huge labor of love. It's taken, you know, so many people have come forward and helped make it happen. And so I'm really excited to share it for a second time in this way, away from SFU. Yeah, that's it. That's all I'd say.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with me.
Amazing. Thank you so much as well. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. My conversation with Alexandra Caprera. Ultraviolets is playing Thursday, November 21st and Friday, November 22nd at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media, which is 577 Great Northern Way. Up next, we'll hear my conversation with Teya Kasahara. He is the creator, co-creator, and star, lead actor in Eurydice Fragments, which is the feature performance at IndieFest. And that opens also at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media tomorrow, Friday, and runs Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Without further ado, here's Teya.
Hi, my name is Teya Kasahara. My pronouns are they and he. I'm a co-creator and also playing the role of O in Renaissance Opera's Eurydice Fragments.
Thanks for joining me today, Teya.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
I want to start by just talking a little bit about sort of who you are and how you come to all of this. In doing a little bit of research, you have an astounding volume, scope, and quality of work. From singing opera and other traditional and contemporary music to collaborating with Jeremy Dutcher to creating and performing in these innovative and boundary-pushing interdisciplinary theater works, I guess. It's hard to know exactly where to start. We can't talk about everything you've done because we would be here for days.
You're very kind.
But maybe can you let me and our listeners know how you come to making art and to singing and to all of this? Like, how does that happen, I guess?
Definitely. Yeah. Well, I went to UBC. That's where I studied music over 20 years ago. And I always loved music growing up. So that's what kind of just led me to this art form, like the extraordinary things you can do with the human voice. I think that's what really initially pulled me into opera. And I took the traditional path because that was primarily like what was available to me or what was offered. And in doing so, I just felt like I really struggled with who I was as a person and also coming into my queerness and then later my transness, and saw that adjacent art forms like theater, combining different art forms and creating new work is where I really started to find my own creative artistic foothold, so to speak. And for the past, I would say 9 or 10 years, that's where I started creating my own shows, but also collaborating with others who are doing this on an indie level and now large scale with all these different adjacent technologies that we have in the show that we're bringing to Vancouver.
Right. And I guess, you know, for anyone who is creating works that are new ways of thinking about the art form or different and not traditional, you're always, maybe not always, but it seems to be that you come up in that traditional system and then sort of recognize what those boundaries are or have those boundaries imposed on you or run into what they are. And then that shapes what you do from there to an extent, right?
I think so. Like, that was definitely the path that I took. And it provided a foundation. It provided a great understanding of like the historical context, the tradition, so to speak, like what I could do with my voice and what I could do with this art form. it's provided a container that I can push against and push through versus going the other way and just coming up with these ideas kind of more or less, I don't know, in a vacuum or from lack of experience.
Mm-hmm. Sort of have to know what you're subverting before you can subvert it to an extent.
Exactly. Exactly.
In that context, do you have a creative ethos or vision or like mission that you try to accomplish through all of your work?
I think if I had to boil it down to something, it would be about honesty or truth, whether that is the truth of the character that I'm creating or exploring, or being honest with myself, being honest and open with my co-collaborators or my co-creators about even having like trepidation about something or feeling like, you know, I have this sense of like, we shouldn't be doing this, quote unquote, you know? So I think bringing that honesty to the table is where I can start to unlearn some of maybe the harmful traditions that are still ingrained in me and where I can reprogram and put in new habits that are healthy and healing and coming from more of an abundance place, a place where new art can happen versus repeating old stuff that maybe keeps me locked in.
You mentioned earlier sort of coming into your queerness, coming into your transness. Has that shaped that desire to create newness and find a different space within the opera community?
Yeah, for sure. Like it's continues to be a process for me, figuring out who I am and also figuring out the kind of art that I want to be doing and the different stories that appeal to me right now. So it really feels like nothing is fixed, or it's like all of a sudden, oh, I've got it. This is the answer to my queerness, or this is the answer to my art. It doesn't feel like it's just a switch and I'm done. So as cliche as it sounds, like the journey has been wonderful and always giving just new ideas, new curiosities, a chance to take root. And I don't even really know exactly where, you know, the art will take me or where even I will feel a year from now or 5 years from now. But continually, I think following what feels right and following honesty feels the best for now.
Well, it sounds like discovery and intuition and, like you said, honesty is the big part of it. Can you put into words what art does for you, what making art, how it makes you feel, or what it accomplishes for you?
Yeah, so much. I think it offers an arena for me to just express, a place to understand thoughts and feelings, emotions that I can't necessarily put words to. It offers a place where these thoughts can enter through my body and out of my body in a way that feels safe versus maybe, you know, doing something that like might hurt my body. It's like I go too hard at the gym or something like that, you know, or if I yell at someone on the street, I don't know, just like more extreme things. But through art, I feel like it is an arena basically, or a playground where those really difficult issues and difficult experiences have a place to become something else, to literally transform into something that we can share with my colleagues or with an audience, and hopefully they can also feel something from that and experience something.
And we're here today to talk about your latest work, which is Eurydice Fragments, which runs at the Signal Studio at the Center for Digital Media November 15th to 17th. I've seen it described as a neoclassical transpunk electronic opera, which sounds pretty awesome. How would you describe the show?
That's a great tagline. Yeah, it is a lot of things. It is a new work. It combines opera, electronics, pop singing, soul, rock. We have four live musicians, and one of them is a beatboxer, a specialist with their voice to make sound effects. We have motion capture. We have virtual reality. There's projections. There's lighting. So like, you're definitely going to hear opera singing, but you're going to hear so much more. You're going to see so much more. And the story is a story that like we've created like in the now, you know, in our 21st century, even though it is based on or inspired by the Orpheus and Eurydice ancient Greek myth. It's a co-creation. There's so many different types of people who have been involved, even in the development process. But in this final iteration, to create such a multi-layered work that has really taken root, I think, in all of our hearts.
You mentioned the sort of inspired by the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Why ancient Greece? Like, what about this particular story inspired you?
This myth has inspired many, many iterations. I think it's the most well-known story, even with like within the operatic canon, that there's hundreds of versions of this story. And I think what was really beautiful about this is that we saw the two characters of Orpheus and Eurydice as two parts of a whole. We saw them as kind of fractured selves of one person, and that our protagonist goes on this journey in order to recover parts of themselves that have been left behind or have fractured. And that we're not necessarily saying that transness is a journey for a person to reconcile themselves, but like any person, whether you're cisgender, transgender, whatever, that there are parts of ourselves that we might suppress or that we might not fully be honest about. And that hopefully this can inspire people to embrace all of who they are and to love all of who they are and to be able to feel safe enough to share that with the people that they do love.
You mentioned this is a work of collaboration co-created with Luke Hathaway. What can you tell me about Luke?
Luke is an amazing poet and writer. He's based out in Nova Scotia and also comes from trans experience. And so when we met a few years ago online, when Debbie Wong, the artistic director of Renaissance Opera, was asking me to be a part of this show, to play this character, the lead role, and also to come on as a co-creator for story, I just felt like this wonderful, instant warm connection about Luke. And he has such a beautiful way to sculpt words and to weave these poetic moments into our script, but also like very, very realistic scenes as well that just feel like, you know, you're just like in a narrative play. So it's wonderful to be able to bounce ideas off of multiple people versus just having, you know, one person dictate, this is how it must go and this is how you do it. So it's constantly even distilling in our rehearsal process right now. Like we're tweaking words a little bit here and there just to make it feel like it really lands and it really, yeah, just feels real to the specific actors who are playing these characters in our show.
So you're asked to come in and be the lead in the work and also co-create. Is that a familiar process to you, coming in and originating and creating this whole thing that you will be part of?
It's getting more and more familiar. I created my first show called The Queen and Me. I started that process about 7 years ago, and I'm the performer in that show as well. And it just feels like such a richer experience to be performing words that have come from your own being or that have come from, you know, a great brainstorm session with colleagues. It feels like the words and a role, like it goes in deeper into my body and I remember it more. I feel like I can bring my whole self to these kinds of projects because it's not just performing a certain type of like heteronormativity or a certain type of femininity in opera roles that are traditional, that are from the canon. So that's a great bonus for sure.
You mentioned earlier the dizzying number of elements in the show, that you've got beatboxing, you've got motion capture, you've got dance, vocal performance, all of this. I want to ask both how that comes together, like how you settle on all of that, but also, I just did an interview with Alexandra Caprara, who is the director and creator of Ultraviolets, which is also playing as part of IndieFest. And she mentioned that she creates with a design-led philosophy, where sort of the stage design and the other design of the play is really influencing the story and the overall creation of the play. Does that resonate with you?
I think it's been a little bit more back and forth. Story has definitely designed where the technology is going in our show specifically. Mm-hmm. However, Renaissance Opera has been developing and collaborating with these technologies for about 5 to 7 years already now. And so earlier iterations of this show, like it was a video game just on its own, like maybe 10, 15 minute video game. And then it was an online virtual reality experience where the audience could pick where they wanted the character to go. this way or that way. And then a few years ago, we've had an iteration where you would see all the tech and you would see the singers. And I had the screen just in front of my face, capturing my face, like when it was opening and closing as I was singing into a mic. And then we would have a dancer doing the motion capture. And so the audience was like privy to all of the behind the scenes, so to speak. And in this version, we are trying to integrate all of these learnings, but also how we design the story and how our protagonist is going on this journey into the quote unquote underworld, so to speak, which is an online platform, social media platform that we've created for this show. And there is an in real life pop-up called the Styx. They enter this space, but then their whole experience catapults into this virtual space as well. So we have these dual, these meta experiences going on for the audience to witness. And we've also put up a bit of the curtain, so you don't get to see all of the magic that you were in different iterations. So it has a purpose now. The motion capture when it's happening, or when you're seeing certain projection or certain memories pop up, and when you're having the physical actors in the space doing what they're doing as well. So I think it's been a bit of an ebb and flow over the years, for sure.
Well, it sounds very interesting and very modern and very relevant and poignant. It seems like really a story for today. So I want to ask in closing, what you hope that audiences will take away from Eurydice Fragments.
I hope that they take away that they feel that there is a sense of like belonging, that every person is striving to belong, no matter who they are, where they've come from, what they've experienced, that we all want to feel loved. And this person just happens to be trans, and that they are deserving of love, just like everyone in the world. And that it is scary to be vulnerable, to be completely honest with people, you know, about who you are and where you're at in life. But that when one can be honest and vulnerable, that embracing someone is such a beautiful feeling, and that we can learn and feel stronger, you know, as a community, or even just like in relationships one-on-one, or as a family unit or something like that. And that love is love, you know, and that, yeah, especially in these hard times, you know, with what we're seeing in the world, it's important to tell people how you feel and to be honest, because sometimes they don't know, or they forget, or they get scared. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know about yourself or about Eurydice Fragments?
I think I shared a lot. I don't want to spoil the show. It's going to be so much fun. It's such a great time, and everyone has really brought all of their best selves to this rehearsal process, and we can't wait to share it with you. So please come on out. We have got 4 shows this weekend. So yeah, I would love to share it with you.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Taya.
Thank you.
My interview with Taya Kasahara, who is the star and co-creator of Eurydice Fragments, that plays starting tomorrow, November 15th to November 17th. You can find out more information about IndieFest and grab tickets at reopera.ca. That's reopera.ca. And you can find tickets there and information about Ultraviolets, Eurydice Fragments, and more. And now joining me remotely is Stephen. Hello, Stephen. Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Stephen? Well, let's try that again. Stephen, can you hear me?
Yeah, a little bit.
Oh. There you are.
Here we are.
All right, Stephen, you're joining us to talk about the East Side Culture Call, right?
Absolutely. So I'm here to talk about the East Side Art Culture Call, which is taking place November 14th to November 7th, basically starting today. And it's basically a been running for 28 years. It's a four-day visual arts showcase and involves 500-plus artists on Vancouver's east side opening their studios to the public. The event is focused on the area bounded by Columbia Street, First Avenue, Victoria Drive, and the waterfront, and involves painters, jewelers, sculptors, furniture makers, weavers, potters, printmakers, photographers, glassblowers, and more, from emerging artists to those internationally established. I actually got to talk to a couple of the artists who were involved this year. Specifically, I spoke with Darren Wright and Andrew Call. Darren Wright is an artist that is, she's a sculpturist, and she creates sculptures. And she specifically specializes in food sculptures as well as multimedia installations. One of her ongoing projects is a massive sculpture of all the items, all the 12 items involved in a Ukrainian Christmas dinner. And that's a fascinating thing which might be in progress when you visit her studio. Angel Kao is a really cool visual artist who does essentially greeting cards as well as stickers and other kind of consumable items. And I spoke to her about her creative process, how she got started in the middle of COVID, and how she's looking forward to having everyone visit her studios. In any case, please feel free to drop by at the Eastside Arts Cultural Crowd. It's starting today, running from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. On Thursday and Friday, that's today and tomorrow, as well as 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday, that's this weekend. And if you go to the website, culturecrowd.ca, you'll be able to see the program and the route and the map, and it'll be really cool. So, yeah, everyone go out and visit, and it's completely free. So it's great.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the update, Stephen, and we hope everyone will get out to see the Eastside Culture Crawl this weekend.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right. You can also expect more coverage on the Culture Crawl tomorrow during Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon from 10 to 11 a.m. as Charlotte Sistacy is interviewing an administrator at the festival as well as two artists. 10 to 11 a.m. tomorrow on CJSF. And now we're going to hear another piece that I did. This one is about, well, you'll find out right now.
It's spawning season for salmon, and creeks across British Columbia's lower mainland are overflowing with mature salmon, making the return journey home from the oceans where they matured to the placid pools upstream where they will spawn, deposit their eggs, and start the cycle for the next generation of salmon. Many of these fish began their lives as alevin, or baby salmon, at the Mossum Creek Hatchery and Education Center in Port Moody. And this weekend at the center, a different kind of youngster will start their own journey as kids attend Homecoming, the Journey of the Salmon, to learn about the famous fish and its importance to the ecosystems it inhabits. Simona Hutnyakova is the founder of the Salmon Forest School and is organizing the hands-on learning experience for small fry. Her forest school, which approaches education from a holistic and alternative perspective, was inspired by a walk in the woods.
So every time when I need inspiration, I go to the forest. And my favorite walk is in Capilano River, which is close to the hatchery. And I went there and I was like, you know, like a light bulb. I was like, salmon. I look at the water. Water gets nutrition from salmon. Trees get nutrition from salmon, all the plants, all the animals, and us as well. Then I came home and I started like drawing like a circle that fish was in the middle and all the animals. And you know, it was like every time, like more and more and more. And I always knew like I wanted to pass all my knowledge and all my experience I learned to the little generation. That's how Salmon Forest was born.
Once the idea had taken root, Simona needed a home for the salmon forest.
Like, firstly, I was maybe a little bit foolish and I thought I can just do it from the park, which, you know, everyone told me that it's not that simple. And then I was like, okay, I need to think outside of box. And I literally, what I started to do was on Google Maps, and finding hatcheries. Because the main point was like, okay, I would love to do forest school camp or any forest school program. And let's say just go on a field trip to hatchery that we can have like hands-on experience. And then I found Mawson Creek. And when I opened their website, they were renting the facility. And I was like, okay, let me see.
The moment she arrived at the Mawson Creek Hatchery and Education Center, she knew it was a perfect fit.
We're good. Okay, so, yeah, very cool, right?
Yeah.
I know, when I saw it for the first time, I was like, oh my goodness, this is dream, you know? Honestly, I almost cried because I was like, you know, like when you have that feeling that you feel like you're home. And that really reminds me from my childhood because my dad used to work for a forest in Slovakia. And like when I would visit my dad in his job, it would be like exactly like what you see on the shelf, like all the bears and, you know, like all the animals and all these books about anything from the nature. And when I came here, I was like, I'm gonna do anything it takes to get the place, you know.
Initially, Simona was nervous about her new project.
Of course, you know, stress and everything. It was very like, how I'm gonna do it, right? Like new community, like nobody knows me, and the trust, right? Like I'm gonna be playing with kids outside in the forest, in an area where there are bears, cougars. But I was just like so positive about it. Like I think my positiveness was like overachieving everything.
But the salmon forest was an immediate hit.
So we started in spring, and first week was very cool. Like, you know, we connected with children and everything. And the second week we sold out. Wow. So we were actually full. Then the next summer, I didn't have to really do any marketing because all the kids, they came from spring break. They actually brought their friends. So I was like, yes.
Salmon Forest students are immersed into the Pacific Northwest ecosystem and use salmon as a focus to develop skills and learn about a wide range of topics.
All the education, it's going around the salmon. Every time when I see what we are learning from sustainability, every time I can see like salmon could be part of it. Because if, you know, we are talking about pollution, if we are talking about, I don't know, like anything else, you know, always you can talk about salmon and how if we do this, this will benefit salmon.
By taking students out of their traditional learning environment, the Salmon Forest provides opportunities to discover, imagine, and be inspired in ways they might never have achieved in a typical classroom.
All the learning is play-based and child-led as well. So at the end, one boy came to me and he's like, so we're not learning anything today? And I just smiled because I was like, okay. And then I went through the whole day and he answered exactly everything. And I just smiled. I was like, no, we're not learning anything today. Because if they see like, oh, I'm just playing, right? But, you know, like this is the thing, like when we play a game, the game has so many different meanings. It's just like, you know, like, okay, how do you play with other children, right? It gives you like the sense of social skills, right? Okay, now we play a game, very famous game, very within the kids. It was about a salmon, mosquito, and a bear. You learn about the life cycle, right? And who eats who and stuff like that. And but, you know, in kids' mind, it was like free time, we're playing, right?
Khutnyakova says she's received great feedback from parents about their children's experience with the salmon forest.
So mainly it was that kids were very calm and also that they learn a lot. And I can tell you one very cool and cute example. When dad came and he said we had a skill day that was all about carving, I said to all the kids, like, I trust you. Like, bring your tools, bring your knife. And I said, your, like, my knife? And I was like, yeah, your knife. I am a believer, like, if you can explain them how to do it, right? Like, we did, like, our, it's called blood bubble, right? Like, when you do and play with tools. And they showed me. Some of them, they were very, like, afraid, which I totally was acceptable, right? I was like, okay, if you're not feeling, it's fine. It's not your time. Maybe it will be next day or next year. It doesn't matter, right? But you have to make the choice. So that's what I was telling parents. Like, if kid in that age can make their own choice based on their needs, that's something for me, like, I want, you know, if I wish I wouldn't be like, oh, I don't know, like, what my super buddy's gonna say, right? Because, you know, sometimes you get influence from other people. But I can see more and more kids are really standing up for themselves. And when that boy was carving his hiking stick and he came, when his dad came to pick him up, and we got like an email saying like, I don't know what you did, but I never saw him that proud. And that's the thing that, for example, the day before, like he would be, you know, like playing and doing stuff and not really like curious, right? Because he didn't, I would say like he didn't know what to do because, you know, it's new environment. Sometimes you really like don't know what to do with yourself if you get some sort of freedom or like, oh, they are listening to me, right? And I saw the shift in behavior because I was like, oh yeah, of course you can use your tool. That's why you brought it. And he, you know, like the look in his eyes, like, okay, can I use it? And I was like, you know what? Like, you are excellent in that. Would you mind teaching your buddy? Because I think he's a little bit struggling and I think he needs a little bit of help. And now, you know, from that boy, he becomes a leader. And that was just like, you know, and then I was like, okay, guys, we need to clean up. It's almost time to go home. He was first in the line, ready. Because, you know, he was just like, oh, yeah, they are listening to me. I'm going to listen to them.
Homecoming, The Journey of the Salmon, is a one-day, hands-on opportunity for kids to try out what the Salmon Forest has to offer, including participation in a live salmon dissection. It might seem gruesome, but Simona says it's one of her and her students' favorite experiences and is a great learning tool.
I am super excited. It's an event about dissecting a fish. What we are planning to do, we're planning to do a demo, which is going to be live. It will happen here in Molson Creek Hatchery 2 years ago when I was volunteering for Swim Keepers. We did that by the creek, right by the creek. So you can imagine the smell from the dead fish. And with kids from the forest school program, we came to the creek, we picked the fish. Kids were trying to pick the most greasy and kind of like very smelly. So we picked a few fish, put it on the rock, cut it, and then the learning started. Like, okay, what do you think? We found eggs. What do you think it is? Is it the male or female, right? So everything was based on like guessing and your curiosity, right? And like trying to see like, okay, how the fish and everything inside the fish, we can compare to ourselves, right? So this is the science, the biology behind it, right? And then we can talk about like, okay, the whole life cycle, right? Like how they're coming back when they stop feeding themselves, when, you know, like all the process, how it happened. Yeah, and the event and why we do dissection, because I saw it and I saw how it was just amazing stuff. You don't get to do it at school anymore, right? And that's why I want them to give an opportunity, not just, you know, PowerPoint and see like, okay. Because that's the best how they can understand and remember. That's why we are trying to keep the group very small, because it's very hands-on learning and very experimental. And we'll be dissecting one fish, which we actually got from an egg intake that happened last month. So this season we got chum salmon. Those are big fish, so I'm very excited. So while Shelly will be doing the demo, all the other kids and every other participant will do their paper dissection. We can have, you know, any questions and, you know, like whoever wants to touch it or, you know, so it's more than welcome to do that. And of course, we'll go through all the cycles, all the species that are coming to our water. We'll be doing a creek observation as well, because that's how you learn the best. And below us is the hatchery, So right now, because we did the egg intake only a month ago, so in the incubator, right now we have all the chum eggs. So finger crossed for the next generation.
Kids who attend Homecoming, The Journey of the Salmon will get a chance to take a break from screen time, exercise their curiosity and imagination, and do some hands-on, play-based learning.
I'm trying to step out as an educator. For example, if we go to the forest, because we go like in this area, but also in the forest, we call it fairy circles. Those are like wooden stamps around, and it's only forest area. So, of course, the favorite part is nature pee. I usually carry like two baskets full of tools. They have like field guides, all ID cards that you can find, plants, mushrooms, trees, anything, measuring tape, ropes, scissors, and, you know, all kinds of tools. And usually, like, first day of the camp, like, I tell them, like, okay, this is your tools. Those are not toys. These are tools. So first, you know, we need to go through the process of explaining what's the meaning of the tools and what's the meaning of the toys. And when tools, it's becoming a toys. It needs to go away. And the reason why I'm doing those baskets is just like, I really want them to come to me and be like, oh, cool. You know what? I came with this idea, but I need something, right? And that's what I need. Like their curiosity, and they, like, they are the one creating something new. And, you know, like that imagination, because I've noticed it's disappearing. And we are trying through child-led play and storytelling, which is a big part, right, to tell a story. So
Homecoming, The Journey of the Salmon, will run Saturday, November 16th from 1 to 2:30 p.m. at the Mossum Creek Hatchery and Education Center in Port Moody. Tickets are available on Eventbrite, and you can find out more about the Salmon Forest at linktr.ee/the_salmon_forest. From Port Moody, Jesse Wenslaw, CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, reporting. This piece is made possible by funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and is made available to media outlets across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Hello, boys and girls. My name is Fat Lip, and this is my friend, Sammy the Salmon.
What to do?
Today, we're going to teach you some fun facts about salmon and a brand new dance. Let me introduce to you a brand new dance. I know you're going to love it if you give it one
chance. Check out Homecoming, Journey of the Salmon. Once again, linktr.ee/the_salmon_forest. You can look up the Salmon Forest on all social media platforms. And sign your kids up for the event on Saturday. Or just go check out the Mossum Creek Hatchery. Cool stuff. And now, the last piece for the day, which comes from Danny. And this is a cool piece about a cool program in Burnaby.
Whether it be brass, woodwinds, strings, shakers, or even synthesizers, the sound of music has become much more accessible for Burnaby residents thanks to the Harmony for All program, which offers free instrument lending, music outreach programs, and community groups and scholarships for those wanting to participate in music lessons. Recently, the program won the Creative City Network of Canada's IDEA Award, which recognizes the significant contributions of any individual, organization, or municipality working in the cultural sector that exemplifies the principles of inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility through cultural programs. Since being recognized for this award, CJSF was able to sit down for an interview with Tanya Rankin, the Fine Arts Coordinator for the Harmony for All program, to speak on the inspiration behind the program as well as the ways in which they hope to grow in the future. Please take a listen to some of what she had to say.
It was actually inspired by one of our city councillors, Councillor Joe Keithley, who's the lead vocalist and guitarist for the punk band DOA. As a lover of music himself, he really felt the impact through his childhood and through adulthood being involved with music and feeling the connection that music brings and that it's a universal language. You don't have to speak the same language or be interested in the same things. If you're connected through music, you can be connected anywhere with anybody. and he wanted that to be true for all of the residents of the city of Burnaby.
Next, during the interview, we asked Tanya Rankin whether there were any current barriers of entry for the program, as well as what the application process is like for instrument lending, musical education outreach programs, and the scholarship opportunities provided by the Harmony for All program.
It depends what you're wanting. So for the lending, anybody can apply. It's a quick and easy online application. And we just want to know what your intent is and why this is important to you. Tell us that. And then if we have the instrument you're requesting, we have 400 instruments. So there's a lot of options for people. Then we can get an instrument into your hands. With the scholarship program, because it's actually a financial commitment from the city of Burnaby, we do require proof of low income status for those individuals. So it's not a barrier, but more of an opening for people who are experiencing financial restrictions to getting music education. So people can borrow an instrument as well as get a scholarship to help pay for the lessons, which can be quite cost prohibitive with lessons within the city of Burnaby. It's not cash towards the person. It's a lesson in our centers, and we'll help pay for it through the scholarships. The outreach program, there are no barriers. The organizations reach out to us, and if you're serving people who reside in the city of Burnaby, we'll come to you, we'll slot you into our calendar and bring a musical experience to those individuals.
Later on, Tanya explains what the community response has been to the Harmony for All program.
It's been really, really good. We have tried to get into all of the schools, the elementary and secondary schools, and let them know about the possibilities for renting an instrument, not renting, getting a loan of an instrument, a free loan of an instrument. And we are trying to get the word out to as many people as possible that if you live in the city of Burnaby, you can also borrow an instrument. The response from the organizations that serve people with barriers has been pretty phenomenal. They really are interacting with us the most. The 3,500 people we've now served are mostly going through that outreach component. And so all of the programs that we can bring to them, musicians, interactions with musical instruments, it has really made a difference to an awful lot of people who would otherwise never come into our centers.
Another question that we had for Tanya asked how the program was able to source all of these instruments to lend out to the community of Burnaby. Here's what she had to say in response to this.
I would say 99% of them were donated to the program.
Okay.
So when Councillor Keithley came up with this idea, he just put a call out in the local news and through radio ads saying, we're doing this donation drive. If you have instruments in your basement, in your closet, you're not playing anymore, please bring them to us. We're going to try and start a program. And he had hundreds of instruments donated. And then again, a couple of years ago, we did another large drive and another 250 instruments came in. And so we've used the funds connected to the program to service them all, repair those that could be repaired. And we've ended up with an inventory of 450 instruments just from all those donated instruments.
Wow.
And then through some of the outreach programs, we do some really interesting interactions with noisemakers. So we have purchased a number of percussion instruments so that people can always hold something, hit something, shake something, whatever it is. A lot of the people we serve could have physical or cognitive disabilities, and just that ability to have something in their hand or be able to have something in front of them that they can touch has made a massive difference. So those specific things might not have necessarily been donated, but we've supplemented the instruments available. So we now have over 600 instruments available for people to experience.
Lastly, Tanya Rankin explained her enthusiasm regarding the possibility of other local cities adopting similar programs regarding lending out musical instruments. She even has an entire plan set out for those interested in looking into this process.
Absolutely. I've created a template on how to do it, and it wouldn't have to be exactly how we did it. We did it in three stages. We did it with three complete different components. Anybody could take one of those pieces and roll it out. And so what I'm encouraging people to do is contact the program, contact me, and I have it all created. I'm happy to share so other places could do it as well. It was so easy. It took time and just, you know, the time it takes to create anything new, but it's templated. All the work, hard work is done, and I'd be happy to share it with anybody that would be interested in duplicating it in other municipalities or anywhere.
Once again, that was CJSF in conversation with Tanya Rankin, the Fine Arts Coordinator for the Harmony for All program in Burnaby.